We had to swear that you have no money, no job, no property, and no prospect of getting any of those things. And I was eminently qualified. So I got the job.
What was your pay?
Well, the job title was junior interviewer, and the pay was $37.50 every 2 weeks. And one year later, Zora Hurston, she had already written 2 books, but she needed a job, and she took the pulpit oath. And she was also, I imagine, Zora Neale Hurston's student of Boaz, getting a job title like junior interviewer. And some bright person in Washington figured that it would cost Zora $5 less to live in Eatonville for 2 weeks than it would me in Jacksonville. So I got $37.50 every 2 weeks, and she got $32.50 every 2 weeks.
Hmm. Can you tell us how that office was organized?
It was, I might add,
yeah.
When I got the first check, my newlywed, my wife and I went window shopping in Gainesville, and looking at, you know, wondering what in the world we're going to do with all this money.
How was that office there organized, the Federal Writers Project office of Florida?
How was it organized? Well, it was a black unit, a Negro. We called it the Negro unit. We had a slot quota of 200 jobs for the state of Florida. And 8 of those were set aside for African Americans. And in practice, there were seldom more than 5 or 6. And they were all situated in a soup kitchen in the black ghetto in Jacksonville. The state headquarters was also in Jacksonville, but no black member of the project ever set foot in the state office. And they would send a messenger to pick up their checks every 2 weeks. But then when Zora came, I remember our director, Dr. Corita Coors, called 6 or 7 editors, state editors, which I was one, into her office and announced that Zora Neale Hurston, the author, had signed on to the project and was going to pay us a state visit, and that Zora had been feted by New York literary circles and was therefore given to putting on airs such as smoking in the presence of white folks, and that we would have to make allowances for Zora. So Zora came and Zora smoked, and then we made allowances.
I want to ask more about her in a moment, but you mentioned Dr. Coors, who was the director, the black unit, and the regional directors, of which you were one. Were there other people who worked on the project besides these?
Your question reminds me that the Southeastern Regional Director of the Writers Project was Dr. W.E. Couch, of the director of the Chapel Hill Press at the University of North Carolina. And I recall someone in Washington, Sterling Brown was the director of Negro Affairs, it was called, wrote Dr. Couch asking him why he didn't have any blacks on his staff at the regional office. And Dr. Couch replied in his classic Southern response that he'd be happy to if he could only find one, a qualified black. Furthermore, I got into a polemic with Dr. Couch in the course of writing my book, Palmetto Country. I forget what prompted it, but anyway, the letter which he sent me said that I must make up my mind whether or not I believed in democracy and majority rule, and therefore whether or not the white majority in the South had a legal and moral right to enforce racial segregation by law, majority rule. Of course, Confederacy was long since dead. It was no body politic. There are very many counties and a good many states where it had black majorities. But here was Dr. Couch, Chapel Hill, saying a white majority in the South had an absolute right to legally segregate. And of course, I took exception.
What were the main goals of the work of the Writers' Project there in Florida, as you understood them?
Well, the national mandate was to hold up a mirror to America. And so I took it, we all took that to mean the same for Florida, to hold up a mirror. But in practice, the editorial office was divided into two camps. And those who wanted to do just bathing beauties and palm trees and, you know, to attract tourists. And those of us who wanted to show, you know, the warts and all. And I remember I volunteered to write the contemporary scene chapter. And Dr. Course had it mimeographed and distributed to the other editors and called an editorial conference, and one of my colleagues raised his hand and said, aren't we going to have anything in the contemporary scene except, you know, N-word and VD and erosion and Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow and so forth and so on. And no one answered him. On the other hand, when we got down to the wire, the mayor of Tampa flew to Washington to beg them to not do more than mention the African-American section of Tampa. He said, mention it, okay, but don't let it go at that. We don't want tourists going in there.
But these collections that you sent us are these wonderful stories and songs from various ethnic groups and life histories. Who decided that that stuff should be collected? Is that up to you?
No, as I say, the mandate was to hold up a mirror to America, so that's what we were trying to do. And we knew about Ocoee, Florida, the massacre. The Ku Klux Klan put the entire black community to the torch. And there were 30 to 60 fatalities. And we didn't know about Rosewood. Ocoee occurred, Rosewood was 1923, and I think Ocoee in 1920. But we somehow, I don't know how I escaped my knowledge, the cover-up was that good. I'm feeling guilty about talking shop.
Well, I think we're interested in the shop part here. And I'm interested, and I'm about to ask you some real shop kinds of questions right now. And I think most everyone here is interested in knowing more about how you went about the work to collect. If you're getting ready to go to a new place you like Ybor City, where you maybe hadn't been before, how would you get ready for that? And what would you do when you got there?
Well, I was new at, we were all new at the game, and somehow instinctively or something, I instructed the field workers to, when they went into a community, to begin by finding out who was the most influential and respected person in that community. And to make contact with that person and to sell them on the whole concept of as to what we were doing. And after doing that, that enabled the field worker to knock on the door and say, Reverend so-and-so, you know, we've been talking with him and he's very much in favor of this project and so on. So that this was an entree which worked. And at the same time, I suggested that you would find in most communities in one or more persons who had made it their lifetime avocation, at least, to absorb all of the the traditional culture of that group. They were sort of the high priest or priestess of the oral culture in that particular enclave, and to identify them and pick their brains. I think I call them ambulatory repositories.
I think a lot of us who are involved in oral history work, if we're doing a fair bit of it, particularly on one subject, find it helpful to get a condensed explanation of what we're doing. And I'm wondering if you had an explanation that you used.
Some decades later, I was giving a course in oral history at the University of North Florida in the 1980s, I guess it was. And someone brought in a video of, you know, how to do oral history. And it showed the oral historian drive up to a home in a van and get out with a bunch of equipment. And the informant came running, jumping out of the house and running over to shake hands. In all my experience, I never saw an informant come running out of the front door. So I don't know who made that film. On the other hand, I was urging my people to, when they were absolute strangers, first of all, our field workers were mostly women, housewives, and I know the academicians are concerned, feel that they have something of a project and a problem in establishing rapport and collecting oral history. But back then, with our housewives, there was no such problem. They could knock on any door and the rapport was already there because of the same language, same culture, and so no problem. But I suggested as a matter of technique, for the most part, we had no recorders. The wire tape recorder and the intervening wire recorder had not yet been invented. And the big machine, which you mentioned, came along a bit later. We had no access at that time in the beginning. And so I said, don't come walking in with a pad. My colleague, had a team teaching the class, and she was new to oral history likewise, and she was working in communications department. But she was telling the students when her turn came to, it was a question of how to dress and so on. I think she suggested maybe khaki and whatnot. And I interjected and said, no, we don't want to go out there looking like mosquito control. And I said, you're a bunch of, you're college kids, and you have no reason to try to look like anything else but college kids, and let it go at that. But of course, there's an element of truth. If you're white collar and interviewing blue collar, it might pay to do some, pay some attention to the matter of dress. Mm-hmm. I recall one of a friend, a neighbor, an attorney, and an example of how important dress could be, that in his law office he had a coat hanger with at least three or four different coats and different hats and different ties, and depending on which county he was going to be pleading the law in as to which coat and hat and tie he wore. And he's saying things like, sometimes when there's a race question of what black and white, case, he would say, I would pick my jury and rest my case, knowing that if he had the right Klan physiognomy on his jury, he didn't have to say anything. No matter what the evidence showed, they would vote to have the guilty, the black defendants would be held guilty. So that's the way it was back then.
Earlier today, we were talking about people's reaction to recording equipment. And, of course, when you had equipment, a lot of people hadn't seen any of that stuff at all. You told me the story about Eartha White. Can you?
Yeah, let me elaborate before that. I suggested these women, even though the report were there, to not come in with a notepad and pencil in hand, but to get acquainted first of all, and if possible, if the circumstances and time frame permitted, to pretty much try to become a friend of the informant. And having done that, and sometimes breaking bread of any kind, or having a Coke or whatever, would help establish a bond before you started taking notes. But then to let them get into, and to stay away from chronology, my name is so-and-so, I was born so-and-so, and I went to elementary school so-and-so, and, you know, that can be pretty awful. But I remember when in the ex-slave interviews, Dr. Botkin, who I consider to be the dean of everything we've been doing in the field of folk culture. Botkin contrived a questionnaire to guide the people who were going to do slave interviews. And in most cases, there were white interviewers. And so you had a white-on-black situation, except in Florida, where we had our little half-dozen Afro-Floridians. We had a black-on-black, and the difference in the quality and content has been noticed by historians ever since. How superior that was. But where was I? What was I?
Dr. Botkin.
He drew a questionnaire, and one question he said was, how did you make soap? And the result, we got back 3,017 answers, all identical. So questionnaires are not always the best way to go. I may want to get back to my notes here in a minute. The first time that we received the recording machine, which was about the size of this table in half, and extremely heavy, it took two men to carry it, and if we went out on the railroad tracks or the shrimp boats, we had to take two automobile batteries to operate it. Anyway, our first run was over to the soup kitchen in the Black Ghetto in Jacksonville, the Eartha White Mission. And they were singing a spiritual, Lord, I'm running, trying to make 100. 99 and a half won't do. And so I was recording, and I learned that I pretended to play back to check the machine, see if it was working. But I learned that hearing one's own voice, the informant's really, they may have been started out very shy about all this, but the minute they heard their own voice, they were all ham actors and fighting for the mic. And so I played back, and Eartha White, the head of the mission, said, hold everything right there. We're going to have a little prayer. And what she prayed was, Dear Lord, this is Eartha White talking to you again. And just want to thank you for giving mankind the intelligence to make such a marvelous machine, and for giving us a president like Franklin D. Roosevelt, who cares about preserving the songs that people sing. Amen.
The panel agrees that that's a beautiful way to end. This was all about oral history. Thank you for coming.